accession number 20937, Reel 2.
Neville Howell, Reel 2.
Yes, the bombardier and the orderly officer went to all of the Australians to put the lights out. The Australians did no more than saying, OK, you want the lights out? They drew revolvers and they shot them out. And that's how indisciplined they were, or undisciplined, I should say. Needless to say, no action was taken against them. I think the Australians were viewed with a certain amount of awe, if I can put it that way. And then we packed up, departed, and moved off. That's the main people from the regiment. That's all the permanent staff, if you like, together with any recruits that we still had. And we went up to Lancashire. And there we were quartered in an old mill.
Is this the same regiment?
Yes, yes. This is still the 36th Signal Training Regiment, RA. We were quartered in an old mill where we continued training, new intakes, and whilst there, I was given a second stripe, so I now had two stripes on my arm. And
whereabouts in Lancashire was this?
An old mill was situated between Worley and Clitheroe. The mill itself was in a bad state. It had fallen down in places, and there were holes in some of the floors that we had to occupy. And yes, that's where it was, between Worley and Clitheroe. Yes, I was given a second stripe, and so things continued. I by now had finished with duties as a trumpeter. I was, 17 years old. And eventually it was decided to disband that regiment altogether. And I was posted off to Hitchin, where I joined the anti-tank regiment, anti-tank training regiment. We were in civilian billets, and the part where I was a large house with plenty of room outside, plenty of large grounds. And there, for the first time, I was introduced to the little two-pounder anti-tank gun, which I believe was the smallest piece in the artillery. I had to learn fast, having stripes on my arm, so that I could teach other people coming into the regiment. At that time, I was able to pick up things fairly quickly, and I then also had to take my turn in mounting guard at the regimental headquarters, in charge of the guard there. Everything was, of course, carried out everywhere. It was blacked out, and I had to provide part of my guard as a patrol over the garden area near regimental headquarters. I ordered the patrolmen, who took the only timepiece amongst us, I ordered them to, when it was time to change guards, to change patrol, to come back to near the guard room. And at midnight, my two men who were on patrol in the large area outside came back to the guard room. Unfortunately, this coincided with the regimental police coming to the guard room as well. I was charged the next morning with dereliction of duty because I'd allowed the two people who should have been outside on patrol to return to the guard room. I pleaded guilty. I then pointed out that there was only one timepiece, so nobody would know that if I left the guard room to go and find these two men who were supposed to patrol independently amongst all the trees and bushes outside, I didn't know how long it would take me to find them. Then I would have to bring them back to the guard room, get the other two men to go outside. I pointed out there was that the regulations and rules were up the creek, if you like. There was no allowance for this type of thing, only one timepiece, or somebody had to have it. And in the end, it resulted with the case against me being dismissed. All the rules were changed, and my battery commander pointed out that because this is included telling off the regimental sergeant major, who was responsible for these orders, that it wouldn't be worth my while staying with the regiment. And I accepted this and was then quickly posted off to the 73rd Anti-Tank Regiment, which was stationed around Godalming.
What were they equipped with?
2-pounder anti-tank guns. They were equipped with 2-pounder anti-tank guns, the same. And my battery, again, was stationed in a large house in the main. There were stables there, and so we were occupied parts of what had been stables and the rooms, haylofts and all that type of thing. And this regiment was, again, formative in that it wasn't fully up to strength. People were coming in and being posted there from all over the place, including some infantry people were being compulsorily transferred to the Royal Artillery. Some of them were from the Black Watch and that type of thing. And yes, eventually we were up to full strength. We were assigned, we had our own battery, we had our own troops and our own guns. And I was part of H Troop. This was 104/111 battery, where the rest of the regiment were, although they were not far away, seldom saw anybody from the rest of the regiment. We tended to be very scattered in the area. And I was then 18. And in getting close to December 1941, I myself, together with two or three other people who had two stripes on our arm, because they wanted to bring the strength to what it should be for full sergeants, I was promoted to full sergeant. There's three stripes and a gun. And it was this was shortly before we were dispatched on Christmas leave, which was thought could be our last leave as well. And I was told to get the three stripes on my arm with the gun, and off I went on leave. I spent part of that leave back with, I deliberately went to Hitchin, and I had pals there in Hitchin, so they were still there, and I was very pleased when I was able to walk past the military police, the same two people who'd picked me up previously, with three stripes and a gun on my arm, and nothing whatsoever to do with them, since I was from another regiment and on leave. This happened also on that leave. I went to London with one of my pals from that regiment, and he was dressed in civilian clothes because he lived in Hitchin, and he dressed in civilian clothes, but I was in uniform, of course. And yes, I was young, and I looked very young. And in London, we were not far from Scotland Yard at the time, I was picked up by two redcaps. When they started to approach my pal in civilian clothes, left, because he wasn't supposed to be in civilian clothes, he should have been in uniform. And the two redcaps, yes, looked at me, I was young, and unfortunately my pay book hadn't recorded that I was now a sergeant. And I was taken to Scotland Yard and detained there whilst they made contact with the regiment, which was a bit of a job because a lot of the regiment, bar the odd, few odd people, were on leave. All the regiment had gone off on leave. But eventually they contacted somebody in the regiment, confirmed that I was a sergeant, and I was released. Yes, then the time, it was about this time as well when I heard that my brother, elder brother, had been killed in Tobruk, or in the Tobruk area, the relief of Tobruk, in November, that was in November 1941. My father, who had came to see me, he'd heard that the regiment were likely to go abroad soon. The reason he'd heard that is because my mother had told him that once that I was on leave, and at that time I was underage for going abroad with the regiment, and I was required to get my parents' signature. I got my mother's signature, and I forged my father's signature so that I could go with the regiment when they went abroad. My father came down and pleaded with me not to go if I could avoid it because of what happened to my brother. And it was after all my father who had propelled, if you like, both my brother and myself into the army. And but no, the time came for the regiment to have an embarkation leave and go abroad. We went up to Glasgow and boarded our boat, which was a, I say boat rather than a ship, it was a small thing. It was called the Borinquen. It had previously been part of a small shipping company which operated from South America to North America with citrus fruit and about 100 odd passengers or something like that. This boat had now had its, what had previously been outside decks had been boarded up so that they were now inside, and three-tier bunks had been set up lining the whole of the, what had previously been an outside deck was now boarded up to be an inside deck. The specific purpose for this was that it would go to the Middle East, pick up prisoners, and they would be housed in this confined space on everywhere on the boat that had previously been an outside deck and brought back to here or to wherever. But it was assigned to us, and these, we occupied these three-tier bunks. There was very little room in between. The bunks were set up on either side of the what had been an outside deck. They ran the length of the ship. And there was no stowage space whatsoever for any equipment. And we set sail and went down through the Irish Sea on the first night. The only space available for our boots and socks and everything else we'd taken off was underneath the bottom bunk. It was very rough going down through the Irish Sea. A lot of water came on board, and in no time at all our stuff which had been put underneath the bottom bunk, and that's from the three tiers of bunks, if you like, on either side, was slopping backwards and forwards along the whole deck, because not only in the boarding up had they enclosed it, but it also prevented any of the water from escaping over the, in this, I believe I called the scuppers in the normal way. So water was swilling backwards and forwards the length of the boat as we rocked up and down and carrying our boots and socks and everything else with it. Anyway, that was our introduction to what was going to be a fairly long voyage. We were in convoy, and we sailed out into the Atlantic. We eventually came back into the African coast at Freetown, where we went into the bay, along with a lot of other shipping in the convoy, where we stayed for about 3 days in the bay. I remember it was very hot when we were allowed on deck, and I could see all the greenery right round the, which was obviously jungle right round the bay. One part was a few small huts and a couple of buildings, which I believe was Freetown itself. Today, of course, it's all built up. And whilst we were there, one of the men on board jumped overboard and swam ashore at night time, because apparently his brother was serving in that area somewhere, Freetown. But he got picked up by the shore police and was brought back to Bolton, confined for the rest of our journey. Also whilst there, the native boys came out in little canoe-type boots and were diving for whatever was thrown over the side in the way of coins and that type of thing. They were also chased away by the police, who had motorboats. And the most memorable thing for me, and I'm sure for a lot of others, because this boat was so crowded, and it was an American crewed boat, and the only food was American, if you like, as an instance, for breakfast would be stewed fruit and highly seasoned sausages, and water, drinking water as such, on the boat. It was switched on for about 1 hour in the evening, some little water fountains, wherever you could get, if you were lucky enough to get that part of the queue which would reach it before the water was turned off again, you had got water. The only other stuff for washing, for bathing and all that was salt water, and we had salt water soap issued, but it was pretty hopeless anyway. I'm sorry I've gone off the point, but yes, on that particular, this one particular day, in the evening, a storm, a rainstorm, if you like. And I can remember us all standing, those of us who could make it, getting up on the outside deck, standing there, naked, with our heads tilted back, trying to catch as much rainwater as we could. And I know it's probably unimaginable, but the whole deck was crowded with naked men with their heads tilted back, enjoying the downpour, if you like, and drinking the rain as it came down. Probably unbelievable, but I can assure you that's one thing I can remember about that.
Because you were so thirsty.
Yes, not because we were so thirsty, although, yes, we were thirsty, but it was an unlimited quantity of lovely fresh water. Yes. There we set sail again with our convoy out into the Atlantic again. We went, and I believe we saw some of the islands that were out in the Atlantic. I forget what they were now. No, one time we sailed past, was it one of those on which, was it Napoleon or somebody had been confined? I forget now which one it was now. One of those islands out in the Atlantic. Anyway, yes, we were apparently at one time we were closer to America than Africa. And we then eventually reached Cape Town. And I remember pulling into the bay there. It was a lovely day. And because of our crowded conditions on board, and it were extremely crowded, we were taken ashore and sent off to a camp about 20 miles also inland from Cape Town, where we could rest, if you like, get over the journey we'd had so far. And yes, we were allowed into Cape Town. It was marvellous. The place, the streets were lit up, all lights. We could buy fruit, which was the main thing which people were looking for, because obviously there'd been a shortage of fresh fruit. We hadn't seen much of it. And we spent about 10 days in a camp inland under canvas with the freedom to go to Cape Town whenever we liked. We could get a train there, we could get the train back again. We did meet some people in Cape Town who were very, very good. They took us home for tea. I wandered around with two or three pals, if you like. I remember one occasion I found myself walking down the main area in Cape Town in the evening, and there was a policeman directing traffic, South African policeman directing traffic, and I remember he stopped one car with a coloured man behind the wheel, and he went across and immediately smashed the windscreen of the car with his truncheon, and smashed the side window with his truncheon, and I can remember hearing the coloured man, who appeared to be Indian, of Indian origin, if you like, saying, "What's the matter? What have I done? I'm a doctor." That sticks in my memory. It was rather upsetting at the time, but we had been told before we left the ship that under no circumstances were we to interfere with anything we saw like that. And that is the one thing that I saw that was like that. I've never forgotten it. I can remember another incident. I'd been in Cape Town for the day. It started raining before we left. I was on a train and to get back to this inland camp under canvas, and it really swamped down. It must have been a tropical storm. By the time I reached this camping area, everywhere was underwater, and I spent that night sleeping on a table because the rest of the camping area was under 2 or 3 feet of water. Excuse me. We then left Cape Town. Part of our convoy had gone to Durban instead, and my part stayed around in the bay at Cape Town. We rejoined, picked up the rest of the convoy when they left Durban as we went past, and we proceeded up round South Africa, up past Madagascar, and then into the Red Sea. So as we approached that part of the convoy left to go to India, we carried on up the Red Sea and eventually reached the port of Aden, where we pulled in to be refueled. Refueling was carried out by these small tanker craft, and this tanker craft came out to us and connected up to us to start pumping fuel on board, and it caught fire. And of course, soldiers being what they were, we got those of us who could reach the outside parts of the boat that were at each end of outside parts of the boat. We stood there watching the fun as the boat that was refueling us was burning, and the shore police came out, and eventually this thing was disconnected from us. And I rather think that I don't know who they were, the Arab personnel on this tanker were probably hauled off and charged with something or other, neglect, I suppose. But yes, that was something that happened to us in Aden. We then carried on, excuse me, and eventually reached Port Tufik in Egypt, where we disembarked, boarded a train, and were taken out into the desert. On that journey, for the first time, we saw how some of these people do their worshipping. The train was stopped whilst the train driver got off, and this was in the evening. He got off and went to one side and knelt down and said his prayers. And when he rejoined, then we carried on to this camping area under canvas in what seemed to be a very isolated part of the desert. We had been issued with topis, and of course we had all our tropical equipment, tropical dress. And I'd been there a couple of days when I was sent on a course to Al-Marza, which is a large camp on the outskirts of Cairo, to do a course, conversion course, on a 6-pound anti-tank gun. So for the first time now, I was looking at the 6-pound anti-tank gun, which was a totally different thing to the 2-pounder. The idea being that I would be sufficiently familiar with it to, when eventually the regiment was equipped, to help people to convert to the 6-pounder back at the regiment. I was there for 4 days, and during this time, I was able, apart from learning all about the 6-pounder anti-tank gun, able to take advantage and get into Cairo. Found myself in Cairo with other people who were on this course, if you like, from the regiment, a couple of them from the regiment. And naturally, we were drawn to the out-of-bounds area, namely Sister Street. And yes, I was one of the people who helped to wear the steps of the brothels. Yes, out of curiosity, we went into the brothels. We understood that from time to time they were raided by the Red Caps, but here we are, if you like, place anywhere out of bounds and it's bound to attract the people who are supposed to stay away from there. Yes, we went to the brothels, and yes, we went up one set of stairs and down another. They were stone stairs, and they had been well worn. I do know that. I'd been told about this before. And yes, they were well worn. And yes, we departed, and you know that we had seen the brothels. And truthfully, I can say I only saw them. I wasn't attracted by anything I saw in them. And neither were the others, just as well, because of the warnings we'd had about venereal disease and that type of thing. Anyway, yes, so yes, I rejoined my regiment. And I was back at the regiment for a couple of days when I was sent with the advance party up the Bluey, as was commonly referred to as up the desert.
How did you get on with Egyptian civilians?
Well, I didn't have a lot to do with them. I can recall a couple of things, if you like. One is that outside this camp, these boys who wanted to clean your boots, obviously want to earn money, you were pestered by them. And yes, they were very good shots with their spittle, if you like. If you didn't want your boots cleaned or wouldn't let them clean your boots, they could spit from a fair distance and it would land on your toe cap. And you needed them cleaned. That was one of the tricks they got up to. Having said that, I voluntarily had mine cleaned. The other thing was that I didn't, at that time, have a watch of any kind. I went into a shop and bought a watch. And it served me very well throughout the rest of that campaign, because it was a little wristwatch with a double case, which proved excellent for keeping out the dust and that type of thing. Anyway, that's just by the way. Yes, I was sent on the advance party up the Bluey. And yes, very quickly learned how to operate our little Tommy cookers and how to produce a meal from the sparse rations, if you like, biscuits and bully beef and odd bits and pieces. And by the time the regiment moved up, and let me say that I didn't see much of the regiment as such, because being anti-tank gunners, we very seldom operated as a regiment. It was always as independent batteries, and even within the batteries you operated as independent troops, so that you were well scattered at times. But anyway, yes, the regiment moved up, and eventually we were given orders for our what was likely to be our first action. Of course, we could hear the guns. I heard guns firing in anger for the first time, and our first action was supposed to be an evening action in support of the Australians who were making an attack on a ridge. We were taken to our area. The battery was taken to the area from where we would kick off. There was a track leading off the main coast road. This is at the Alamein area, if you like. And we were supposed to follow the Australian infantry where they carried out their attack. The main axis of advance was down this track, if you like. Tracks. All the tracks in the desert at that time had well-known names, the main tracks. But anyway, at the last minute, it was decided that we would only be in the way of ambulances and that type of thing, and we weren't really required, so we were held back, if you like, and we didn't take part in that attack. Needless to say, before our participation was cancelled and was in that position, yes, I felt the need to go to the toilet, and I grabbed a shovel and off to one side I went, and I saw that quite a few other people were doing the same thing. Presumably this was the effect of nerves, which I encountered for the first time. And yes, it was some time after that, I don't know for how long, we moved around many times close to the lines, if I can put it away. We were often in front of the gun lines, between the gun lines and the infantry lines, if you like. Nothing I can remember on one of these occasions, the battery captain decided that he would take all the vehicles out for driving drill. Driving drill, of course, we had no means of communication except by hand. So we could give all types of hand signals. And we were out, we knew what distances to keep. We could be the leader of a convoy, if you like, could indicate how far apart he wanted people, whether to turn right, what speed, etc., etc. Anyway, we're off, and the battery captain was in charge. We're off on driving drill. Well, we drove off, and eventually we were passing some, and I saw some trenches, and there were people in those trenches, and they appeared to be crouching down and keeping low.